Well, I imagine that most of us have been brought up, as I was, in starting to understand the Bible with the old division of many of Paul's letters, that part one contained the theory, and then after the break he came back with part two, and you had the practice. And of course there's a truth in it. But we mustn't ever totally divorce the one half from the other. And Titus chapter 2 is a very healthy warning to us, particularly when you look at verses 11 to 14, which is the short paragraph I want to be concentrating on this morning and next Sunday. The first 10 verses contain lots of instructions for practical Christian living and how to train people in it. And then there suddenly appears this short paragraph. And it's not as if Paul is saying, by the way, Titus, don't forget the gospel. It's not as if he's one of those overzealous evangelists who are endlessly slipping tracts everywhere that they can think of, under the guest room pillow and so on. And he thought, it's a long time since I've mentioned it. It's time I got back to it again. No, he's actually saying, isn't he, in these three or four verses, here's why we live like this. He begins verse 11, "For." Do this, do this, do this, for this reason. See, it's very important to know why I'm to live the way I'm to live. It's very important that I know that as well as what I'm meant to do. If I'm a Christian and I don't know why I live as a Christian, sooner or later I'll turn it over. Because there are plenty of others willing to give me endless reasons why I should live differently. If I'm not a Christian and I don't understand why Christians live the way they do, it's very important I understand the answer to that question, or I'll never understand my Christian friends. Paul knows that the only Christians who'll stand are those who understand why as well as what they're meant to be doing. So he explains it in these few verses. He gives the foundation for it, and that's why he can come on to verse 15. Did you notice it tacked in on the end there? Makes no sense unless you've joined 11 to 14 up with the first half of the chapter. He's saying, Titus, don't back down on these things, all of the things you're to teach in chapter 2. Why not? Why are you to exhort and reprove with all authority? Why should no one disregard you? Because the practical ethics are gospel lifestyle. The gospel is your authority on all the issues in the first 10 verses as well as in verses 11 to 14. So let's have a look at this paragraph. It speaks, as you noticed, of the two comings. So it's appropriate to look at it in Advent as we look back and remember Christ's first coming at Christmas, and as we look forward and wait for his second. Well, today I just want to draw three simple lessons, forgive me, they'll be very simple, about Christmas, about that first coming. As we look at verses 11 and 12, let me read them to you. For the grace of God has appeared for the salvation of all men, training us to renounce irreligion and worldly passions and to live sober, upright, and godly lives in this world. And the first point is really very simple. The grace of God has appeared. That's how Paul wants to undergird all his teaching. He says, listen, we must live like this. We must teach our fellow Christians to live like this. Why? For the grace of God has appeared. The point he's making is this. It's not that there is a God and he's shown himself. Actually, that merely starts a whole host of other questions, even if we could get that far. The question is, what kind of God is there? And Paul's claim is that that question has been answered. The grace of God has appeared. We'll discover more about what that grace means as Paul uses it here as we go on, but a starter definition. We won't go far wrong with chapter 3 and verse 4. He speaks about when the goodness and loving kindness of God our Saviour appeared. Now you see, when God appeared, he's told us not only that he is, but he's told us something of who he is. He's a God of grace. And he has appeared, says Paul. That's the word from which we get our word epiphany. It's a rare word in the New Testament. It's used outside of Titus only in two other places. One of them is to describe Paul's shipwreck. And in the days of the storm building up to it, Luke writes like this. He says, the sun and stars had not appeared for several days. They were shining, no doubt, but they hadn't penetrated the cloud cover. Now you see, for many, many people today, they live, don't they, as if the grace of God had not appeared. As if it was like those sun and stars. No, no doubt it may be up there somewhere, but I'm afraid of where we sit, we're under the clouds all the time. It doesn't lead necessarily to any appalling lifestyles. It does lead to what one can describe as the search for God mentality. It actually is going to rule out us ever reaching the point of verse 15 in chapter 2. We can't be as definite as that. We're still searching for God, trying to discover him. It's just difficult to be sure if life is all about searching for God. He's there above the clouds. No, says Paul, we can be definite. For the grace of God has appeared. He's penetrated the cloud cover. Life, Paul is saying, is not like some poker game with God playing his cards very close to his chest. He's declared his hand. It's on the table. If you were here on Tuesday, you'd have heard Chapo tell his delightful story of babysitting and the game of hide and seek the child he had played with him, where the kid announced exactly where he was going to hide it and then told Chapo to look for him. Well, I had a friend with me on Tuesday lunchtime. We went home afterwards, and Anna gave almost an action replay of what Chapo had described when we got home, her version of hide and seek. She went to hide behind the door, having told me exactly that we were to start playing. That was quite an advance for her. Normally she just lies on the floor and buries her face in the carpet and thinks she's hidden. And the fun of the game is this, that I have to go and find her. And my job is simply to think of as many places as I can where she's not. So I look under this table and there's a chortle, and I look under that table and there's a chortle, and I throw a cushion around and there's a chortle. And after a bit she comes out from behind the door to look and see where it is I'm looking next, and stands there watching. And when finally I give up of thinking of anywhere else, I go and find her. And that, of course, is the high spot of the game. She delights in me finding her. All that keeps the game going is my imagination and whether I can keep on thinking of somewhere else where she's not. Because finding her is absolutely no problem. She's standing there, peering round the door. Now, says Paul here in this verse, Christmas ends hide and seek with God. We can only keep that game going if we go on inventing places where God is not. Because he's standing out in the open. The grace of God, verse 11, has appeared. He's revealed his hand. What a lovely challenge to us this Christmas to stop anyone getting away with lines about searching for God. Have they looked where he's appeared? And you see, this has implications. It has the kind of implications for the way we live that has been spelt out in verses 1 to 10. Now we know what he's like. Verses 1 to 10 hold true if we're going to live the way he wants us to live. That's why Paul can reach verse 15 and say to Titus, "Let no one disregard you." The grace of God has appeared. Lesson 2. The grace of God saves. Well, I told you they'd be obvious. Verse 11. The grace of God has appeared for the salvation of all men. Literally, salvation bringing to all men. Paul can't think of God intervening without speaking of the grace of God. He can't think, if you understand his thought at all, of God's salvation without speaking of the grace of God. And he can't think of us serving God without God first having been at work in us. So he knows it's useless us talking in terms of verses 1 to 10 unless God, by his grace, by him taking the initiative, by him reaching down to us, has first saved us. So he speaks in those terms. Now, we know that. I'll take that for granted this morning. I don't want to spend time on this. I just want to make these two points. Do notice the strange way in which he speaks of Christ's first coming. He doesn't say Jesus has appeared for the salvation of all men, though that would be true. He says the grace of God has appeared for the salvation of all men. It is just a warning to us, isn't it, not to separate grace from Jesus or Jesus from the grace of God. I found myself the other week doing a number of dialogues, and I was fascinated to discover that all the people who seemed to be most enthusiastically on my side as I tried to talk about the gospel actually turned out to be completely the opposite. They thought they were ardent supporters of Jesus, and they had him completely wrong. One lady, who merely put it more succinctly than the others, said this in the end. She said, "Look, I do believe in Jesus, and I believe that it's right we get what we deserve." Do you see? If only I'd been looking at Titus by then, I'd have known where to look. She has completely missed the point of verse 11. If I get what I deserve, then I've not received grace. Yet when Jesus came, Paul's able to say, the grace of God has appeared. And he's appeared for the salvation of all men. All sorts, all shapes, all sizes, every conceivable person. Paul has been mentioning almost all types already in chapter 2. There are older men in verse 2. There are older women in verse 3. There are young women in verse 4. And there are younger men in verse 6. And you've got slaves and masters by the time you reach verse 9. So you can take your pick as to which you are. I'll leave you to choose. But it doesn't matter. When it comes to the saving grace of God, it'll reach all types, even the Cretans to whom Titus is having to minister. And I say even because if you know this little letter, you'll understand what I mean. Look back to chapter 1 and verse 12. This horrifying little verse. One of themselves, a prophet of their own, said, "Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, and lazy gluttons." Pithy little addition from Paul. This testimony is true. And it's a good thing it was written a long time ago. We'd never get away with it today, would we? I got ticked off when I was elsewhere the other week for telling an Irish joke. I was told that was racist. What would they think of the apostle writing this? But now see the point of this. You see, people often object to imposing standards. Or they complain about how unfair it is to expect the same from everyone. We're told to remember people's background and circumstances and temperament, and at his age he can't be expected to, or at her age she can't be expected to. Paul says, look, our starting point is the grace of God. And he's come for all men, even liars, evil beasts, and lazy gluttons. That's the reason why every member of the Christian family can and should be expected to live a Christian life. Not that I've been well brought up, but that the grace of God is at work in me. And the grace of God has not only appeared, but it saves all men. So, Titus, you can declare these things. You can exhort and reprove with all authority. You can let no one disregard you. The grace of God works in all types. Lastly, the grace of God educates. Verse 12. The grace of God has appeared for the salvation of all men, training us. Or educating us, that's what's behind the word, and everything that's implied in that. Criticism, teaching, explaining, questioning, encouraging, exhorting, chastising, and so on. Now, I was surprised as I came to this little verse. I don't think I'd really ever taken it in properly before. I was used to the idea of the law educating me, but grace educating? And I started thinking. And then I was surprised that I had been surprised, if that doesn't sound too stupid. You see, of course, it's true to my experience that when the grace of God began to get a grip on me, I found that it wasn't just that He saved me and forgave me. He began to educate me. I can remember, I still know, those occasions when I feel helpless. What am I meant to do now? I can remember the way that grace taught me all kinds of basic things. What little hospitality I have, I think, came from grace. My mum tried to teach it to me. I dare say that politeness would have meant I could have passed muster on the test. But it was only when grace had gripped my life that I began to see a true concern for others and to watch grace in the lives of other Christians, showing me how to think of others. Grace is a wise educator. He does both the negative and the positive. Do you see it? We're trained to renounce and we're trained to live in verse 12. To renounce is to refuse, to say no to irreligion and worldly passions. You don't have to be an atheist to be irreligious. In Gerald Priestland's Case Against God, one of the few really good comments is this one from his in the introduction. One of his reasons for writing, he says, is to resist the spread of largely unconscious atheism in our society. It's not so much that people deliberately renounce God in the way that so many have renounced the churches, but that they cease to behave as if there were a God and seem to regard Him as optional. Now that's telling, isn't it? It's not that I have to say I don't believe in God. Of course I believe in God. I just don't behave as if there were a God. He just becomes irrelevant to me. Must be true of many of our friends. It's true of the kind of people Titus was ministering to here. Look at verse 16 of chapter 1, will you? They profess to know God. They believe in Him. But they deny Him by their deeds. He doesn't affect what they do. In terms of churches, the city could hardly look more religious, could it? You can't walk more than a few hundred yards without bumping into another one. But professing to know God and denying Him by their deeds, we know is all too true. Anyone who's converted will need to be trained, educated, to live as if God were relevant. As if I act under His authority, not just say I believe in it. And worldly passions, all those desires centered on the present world system. A life that's just focused on this world. Without God at work, we are tempted to think of nothing but this world and this life. You ever ask yourself why the man who's earning £300,000 a year, should bother to fiddle the books to get more? Well, presumably it's because he's thinking of nothing but this world. You don't have to be earning those sums. Talking with Michael Schluter as he, just before he spoke to the wives group this Wednesday, he was saying about how his Jubilee group is beginning to look into this issue of personal debt. It is actually at the highest it has ever been in this country, personal debt. Of course, you can understand it. Our moral barriers are at their lowest. People are falling over themselves, both to encourage us to buy things and to lend us money so we can get them. Everyone will give you a mortgage. Anyone who's converted from that background needs to learn how to say no to worldly passions, don't they? People find it very difficult to say no to greed. Lazy gluttons like the Cretans would find it very difficult to say no to greed. We all have our worldly passions we need to be trained to say no to. And to live sober, upright and godly lives in this world. Grace is the one that'll teach us that. That's in every direction. Sober, self-controlled. Upright, fair, just to others around me. Godly, holy, before my God. It does not come naturally. Yes, of course grace educates, I realized as I began to think over this again. Of course I found it was true that when first I was converted, I could say I'm saved, and then I discovered that I wasn't just saying I'm saved, I was in training. And you can't have the one without the other. The God who saves us trains us. I've misunderstood what it means to be saved if I'm not also saying I'm in training as a Christian. And I came from a respectable, at least nominally Christian background. Prophets in my house, though it may be true, didn't actually say of us that we were liars, evil beasts, and lazy gluttons. You see, how today's convert is going to need the grace of God, isn't he, or she? What background do people come from? Very much irreligion. The latest poll on religion, for what they're worth, comes with these findings I heard on the radio this morning. 4 out of 5 people believe in God. Oh, not irreligious. Oh, yes. 1 out of 3 can't even remember the last time they read their Bible. 5 out of 6, I think, don't go near church. They believe in God and they pray from time to time. What views of God will that person bring to a Christian life? All kinds, all sorts, some good, some indifferent, some hopeless. What sort of worldly passions will today's convert be brought up in? You see, if we're actually reaching out where we need to reach out, we're not going to be having, are we, well brought up, Sunday school trained folk turning to Christ, who know all the background and in a sense just need to have the life, and then they can slot in automatically. That is less and less the case. So more and more the case needs to be, if we're going to be a church that reflects the grace of God, we need not only to be reaching out with salvation, but with training. Training to renounce and training to live. Sober, disciplined lives. Discipline is not a word that is common today. How do I live the Christian life without discipline? How am I going to get it if I don't have it? I won't unless the grace of God trains me. This is no extreme example. But Jackie was a young girl who came along to the first little cypher house party we ran. She discovered it through a notice at school. And she just signed up and came along just a few weeks or months before she came. She'd started reading her Bible at home. Her family wasn't Christian. She didn't have Christian friends. But she's picked up her authorized version family Bible and started reading it. When she came down, after about a week, at the end of the house party, someone was talking with her. She said, "Yes, I am a Christian, I've discovered here. All the things you're saying, I can understand what you're saying now, and I realize they're true from what I picked up reading this Bible." She would never have called herself a Christian when she first came down. She didn't kind of know what that meant. And so, much encouraged, people sent her off home, and she went away. And the next year, she came back again. And I don't know how the subject came up, but she was talking with another Christian, and she discovered then that she shouldn't have been sleeping around with her boyfriend for the whole year. She'd done it in innocence. You may say, "Oh, well, she hadn't got very far in reading her Bible." That might have been true. But she had no background. No one had trained her. It was news to her. The grace of God, who educates. Listen to Stuart Briscoe put it this way. He speaks of new believers coming into a church. They've gone forward at an evangelistic crusade, perhaps. They've come into our churches, and they haven't a clue. They've only been Christians for a short time. They know hardly anything of biblical Christianity. They'll come in with all kinds of weird ideas they had before they became Christians. They're going to propagate utter heresy. Their lifestyles will be abominable. And if you actually allow them to open their mouths in a small group in Read, Mark, Learn, or the fellowship groups, we'll discover all of that. "So what are we going to do?" he says. "Kick them out on their ears?" No. We're going to lead them into healthy teaching. And then we're going to show them what is in accord with healthy teaching. We're going to show them what is suitable behavior for healthy teaching. Which is why chapter 2, dealing with new converts who are just like that, is full of all the people who are teaching others in the church. And an awful lot of us are involved. That's why we must not be tired when we hear of teaching and think, "Oh, well, at least that's one thing we get at St. Helens." If we're doing our stuff, if we're actually seeing people newly converted, we're going to need endless answers to questions why. If we're going to reflect the grace of God in our church life, then we'll need to be able to educate into what is a suitable lifestyle in accord with healthy teaching. Grace has appeared. Decisive footprints in history. And lifestyles have to change as a result. Grace saves all men, all types, so the grace life applies across the board. And grace educates. It's a wonderful truth. That God's love reaches down to me just as I am. I wouldn't stand a chance if it didn't. But I haven't really understood how wonderful that love is unless I understand this, that it not only reaches down to me and takes me just as I am, but it loves me enough that it won't leave me there. The grace that saves educates. Let's pray. Father, in your goodness and loving kindness, we pray that you would educate us, teach us to say no, teach us to live sober and upright and godly lives, and then give us a love for others that will share that grace with them, for Jesus' sake. Amen.